Thank you for listening to a reading presented by the Poetry Center of Chicago. The Poetry Center is an independent, nonprofit arts organization promoting poetry in Chicago through readings, workshops, and arts education. To learn more about the Poetry Center, to read poems by our students in Chicago Public Schools, or to donate, please visit www.poetrycenter.org.
Tonight's event brings together two superb American poets, Ted Kooser, who will read first, and Elaine Rawlings. I believe Kooser and Rawlings are a perfect pairing, not only because of the high quality of their work, but because their poems are so different, and contrast often makes for heightened interest, don't you think? Ted Kooser usually begins a poem with an observation outside himself. He lives in the country near Lincoln, Nebraska, and the world of his poems is a fully imagined world of apparently plain people and not outwardly dramatic events occurring in small towns. He also writes beautifully of the natural world, and whatever he touches, fireflies, a blind woman, a night class, a pair of surveyors working on a highway, quote, in their orange doublets like medieval pages, has wider reference than the subject itself, which he handles movingly with wit, grace, and frequently with rue. And he does so in often startling, sometimes quirky images that reverberate in one's mind long after you've finished reading the poem. Take one example. In a poem called Shoes from Weather Central, he writes, "In the shoe store storage closet, the smooth brown eggs of new shoes lie glowing in boxes." He goes on for a few fine lines and then says, "Let us not tell them just yet that they will all too soon be just like the others, their toes turned up from forever walking uphill in the rain." Sometimes a Kooser poem begins with a small event, dawn coming on, and later in October, dawn coming on later and later in a marvelous poem called October, and ends with a moving meditation on, well, what you will, loneliness, isolation, perhaps death. Ted Kooser is a vice president of not one but two insurance companies, Lincoln Benefit Life in Lincoln, Nebraska, and Surety Life Insurance Company of Salt Lake City. He's an adjunct professor of creative writing at the University of Nebraska in Lincoln, and is the author of 8 books of poems and a number of chapbooks. His books include Sure Signs, which was awarded the Society of Midland Authors Prize in 1980 and was featured on National Public Radio's All Things Considered. His other books include One World at a Time, 1985, and Weather Central, 1994, all published by the University of Pittsburgh Press. And so now I think it's time to hear from Ted Kooser.
I've always wanted to enter from the wings like that. It was really a thrill. Ordinarily, you know, they make you sit on the stage while they're talking about you, just squirming, you know, waiting. Come on. I like to begin my readings with this poem. So often over the years, people have asked me, to whom do I address these poems? And this is a poem called Selecting a Reader about that person. First, I would have her be beautiful, and walking carefully up on my poetry at the loneliest moment of an afternoon, her hair still damp at the neck from washing it. She should be wearing a raincoat, an old one, dirty from not having money enough for the cleaners. She will take out her glasses, and there in the bookstore, she will thumb over my poems, then put the book back up on its shelf. She will say to herself, "For that kind of money, I can get my raincoat cleaned," and she will. I write an annual Valentine poem. I've done this for 10 years, and although we're a week past Valentine's Day, I couldn't resist bringing this along. I'll read the poem, and then I have this whole stack of them that I'll give to you later. You can each have a Valentine. What I've done over the years is try to get some little symbol of Valentine's Day buried in the poem somewhere. In the alley behind the florist's shop, A huge white garbage truck was parked and idling. In a cloud of exhaust, two men in coveralls and stocking caps, their noses dripping, were picking through the florist's dumpster, and each had selected a fistful of roses. As I walked past, they gave me a furtive, conspiratorial nod, perhaps sensing that I, too, though in my business suit and tie, am a devotee of garbage, an aficionado of the wilted, the shop-worn, and the free, and that I had for days been searching beneath the heaps of worn-out, faded words to find this brief bouquet for you. I had a great aunt and uncle who lived way into their 90s. They were married for 72 years. And I was looking at some photographs of them, and this photograph really struck me, that was taken when they were in their 60s with many years of marriage ahead of them, and they had already begun to sit 2 feet apart on the bench, and which was typical. They lived in Clayton County, Iowa. There was not a whole lot of choice in mates in those. Would have been in the 1890s. And this poem addresses that photograph. This old couple, Nils and Lydia, were married for 70 years. Here they are 60 years old and already like brother and sister, small, lusterless eyes, large ears, the same serious line to the mouths. After those years spent together, sharing the weather of sex, the sour milk of lost children, barns burning, grasshoppers, fevers, and silence, they were beginning to share their hard looks. How far apart they sit, not touching at shoulder or knee, hands clasped in their laps as if under each pair was a key to a trunk hidden somewhere full of those lessons one keeps to himself. They had probably risen at daybreak and dressed by the stove, Lydia wearing black wool with a collar of lace, Nils his worn suit. They had driven to town in the wagon and climbed to the studio only to make this stern statement, now veined like a leaf, that though they looked just alike, they were separate people with separate wishes already gone stale, a good 2 feet of space between them 30 years to go. This is an experience I think we all share. It's called the urine specimen. In the clinic, a sun-bleached shell of stone on the shore of the city, you enter the last small chamber, a little closet chastened with pearl, cool, white, and glistening. And over the chilly well of the toilet, you trickle your precious sum in a cup. It's as simple as that. But the heat of this gold, your body's melted and poured out into a form, begins to enthrall you, warming your hand with your flesh's fevers in a terrible way. It's like holding an organ, spleen, or fatty pancreas, a lobe from your foamy brain still steaming with worry. You know that just outside a nurse is waiting to cool it into a gel and slice it onto a microscope slide for the doctor who in it will read your future wringing his hands. You lift the chalice and toast the long life of your friend there in the mirror who wanly smiles but does not drink to you. I'll read a few poems from my most recent book. My father told me once years ago that the reason that all the pictures in the grade schools that we all grew up with are the same was because there were salesmen that traveled the country and sold portfolios of those pictures. The wolf looking down on the winter night at the blue cabin with the lights on. The Indian making the pot by the fire, the end of the trail with the Indian with the sagging spear, and so on. And I thought it would be fun to try to write some poems about each of those pictures that we became so accustomed to. And this one is about the Gilbert Stuart portrait of Washington, which, as you know, is that unfinished portrait of Washington with the bottom that is just raw canvas. You know it as well as the back of your hand, that face like a blushing bouquet of pink peonies set in the shadows of war. The father of our country, patient, sucking the past from his wooden teeth. His famous portrait, never completed, hung on the wall at the front of the classroom next to a black octagonal clock with the ghost of a teacher trapped inside, tapping out time with a piece of chalk. It was easy to see his attention was elsewhere. He'd left the dozen campfires burning out there at the front of his face, then retreated behind them. At 58, he was old and broken. This was no way to use up the days of a soldier. Celebrity irked him. He had little time for the likes of Gilbert Stuart, that son of a snuff-grinding Tory, that slackard who'd sat out the war with the English. Perched on a chair in a cold stone barn, according to Stuart, he smiled only once when a stallion ran past. He cared more for thoroughbred horses and farming than he did for the presidency. On the wall between us and the future, at the point where all of the lines converged, George Washington, like any other man, suppressed a deep sigh. So heavy was life, how futile it seemed to protest. We learned our lessons while the big clock clacked, its Roman numerals arranged in a wreath and sealed under glass. Those were lovely calico autumns, then winter passed with its long, clean pennants of light. Then spring with its chaffy rustle. We thought those aisles were parallel, that our days would never arrive at the vanishing point. Before us always, he who could never tell a lie kept his jaws closed on the truth. This is an attack on a kind of headwear. When my father died, in his closet were three of these little polyester hats that men in their 70s wear, made that are so hard that you could stand on them to reach up to an upper shelf, you know, and they have little feathers on the side. And after he died, I began seeing men everywhere wearing these hats, and it occurred to me that perhaps the hats were the engines of their mobility and that the hats were pulling them on. So this is just a little short piece called The Little Hats. I saw the old men hanging down under their little hats as the hats pulled them stumbling along. Those polyester hats with little checkers, with little feathers, yellow and red. And their eyes were wide behind their shiny glasses and their cries pinched off in blue. And when they had passed and the bitter squeal of their cane tips breaking had faded, I saw there in the enormous window of the second-hand store cast off a row of little hats, streamlined and swift, their engines idling. A sound in the night. There's a clock at the end of the pasture, talking and talking. It's my neighbor's new electric fencer, a red tin box with a steady pulse. On a night like this, chilly and still, you can hear it knock for 100 yards, counting the stars with its bony knuckle, a sound absurd against the darkness. But many of us have stopped in our places to listen. A mouse with a globe of dew in her paws, a coyote lifting his head from the grass, his wet tail tipped with starlight. Even my father, dead these 14 years, has heard the flat, remorseless counting and reaches out into the darkness and over the years for my mother's hand. This is the title poem of this book, Weather Central. It came out of watching the weatherman. You've seen them do this. The map is projected on the wall, and they, as they talk, they sort of massage the map. Weather Central. Each evening at 6:15, the weatherman turns a shoulder to us, extends his hand, and talking softly as a groom cautiously smooths and strokes the massive, dappled flank of the continent, touching the cloudy whorls that drift like galaxies across its hide, tracing the loops of harness with their barbs and bells and pennants. Then, with a horsefly's touch, he brushes a mountain range and sets a shudder running just under the skin. His bearing is cavalier from years of success, and he laughs at the science, yet makes no sudden moves that might startle that splendid order or loosen the physics. One would not want to wake the enormous Appaloosa mare of weather asleep in her stall on a peaceful, moonlit night. I'm going to read three more poems and then stop. Hands in the Wind. These are newer pieces. Today I drove through a cloud of leaves, pale oak leaves the color of hands blown over the street, straight toward me out of the empty parking lot of the abandoned Kmart, their fingers swirling about me, feeling all over my car, over it, under it. I don't very often go past there. They must have been waiting a very long time to have been so excited to see me. They had probably blown there from trees in the cemetery just down the block and had gathered to wait, folded over each other, faded old hands with brown liver spots, young hands with a sheen to their skin. Then, when they'd seen my car coming, they'd rushed out into the traffic. It felt as if all of the people I've loved were suddenly swirling about me, wanting to touch me, wishing me well. I found myself laughing with joy. It all happened so quickly, and then they were gone. In the rearview mirror, there were only a few leaves still flying, a few fluttering down. They had settled in drifts by the curb, interlacing their fingers. They'd made a mistake. It hadn't been I whom they'd meant to make happy. They'd thought I was somebody else. This poem's entitled Lobocraspis grisifusa, and it's a scientific name of a kind of moth that I read about in a book by David Quam, and it's a moth that lives on tears. No poet could resist such a thing. This is the tiny moth who lives on tears, who drinks like a deer at the gleaming pool at the edge of the sleeper's eye, the touch of its mouth as light as a cloud's reflection. In your dream, a moonlight figure appears at your bedside and touches your face. He asks if he might share the poor bread of your sorrow. You show him the table. The two of you talk long into the night, but by morning the words are forgotten. You awaken serene in a sunny room, rubbing the dust of his wings from your eyes. I'll close with this one. One of the joys of doing this sort of thing from time to time, traveling around and meeting all the wonderful people out there, and I was in Philadelphia reading at several colleges in Philadelphia, and I was invited for dinner at the home of a couple. The woman, Marcia Wertheim, is the step-granddaughter of John Cornos, who was one of the Images poets largely forgotten today. But she had in her possession, and after dinner she brought these out for me, these boxes and boxes of memorabilia from Cornos, including personal letters from Yeats and Eliot and Pound, and Yeats's little calling cards with little notes written on them, and these wonderful things that just completely blew me away. You know, and I had them all right there in front of me. And then she said, and I know, Ted, that you're interested in painting, that you've always liked painting, so perhaps this will interest you. And she brought out a wooden box and placed it on my lap, and it's that box that's described in this poem. It's called A Box of Pastels. I once held on my knees a simple wooden box in which a rainbow lay, dusty and broken. It was a set of pastels that had years before belonged to the Impressionist Mary Cassatt, and all of the colors she'd used in her paintings lay open before me. Those hues she'd most used, the peaches and pinks, had been worn down to stubs, while the cool colors, violet, ultramarine, had been set, scarcely touched, to one side. She'd had little patience with darkness, and her generous heart had held only a measure of shadow. I touched the warm dust of those colors, her tools, and left there with light on the tips of my fingers, that hand and this heart wrote these poems for you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ted. That was great. Reading Elaine Rawlings might be likened to going on a roller coaster ride through a strange and beautiful country. You will run into manticores there, creatures with, as she puts it, snakes' tails, lions' bodies, and voices like the songs of flutes. You'll experience quirky and wonderful imaginative leaps. She tries to calm her. At one point, when the poet is in an emotional flummox, she tries to calm herself by thinking of peach ice cream. Then in a twinkling, she reminds herself of someone who's had it a lot worse, namely Ezra Pound in his cage, imprisoned by the American Army at the end of World War II. Elaine's poems are witty, wry, sometimes sad, often turbulent meditations on love, or the lack of it. From a woman's point of view, a very intelligent, particular woman. They are brave, risky, and self-revelatory, and are presented in elegant, sometimes slangy, always polished, often glittering language. No one else writes like her. Elaine Rawlings has published three books: Transparent Landscapes, Raccoon Press, 1984, In Your Own Sweet Time, Wesleyan, 1989, and most recently, The Struggle to Adore. It's a title that I think is great. Storyline, 1994. A transplanted Southerner, Rawlings was born in Savannah. She graduated from Bryn Mawr and then attended the University of Chicago, where she was awarded an MA in Far Eastern Languages and Civilizations. She has taught creative writing at Loyola and the University of Chicago. Elaine?
Thank you, Mark. And thank you, Ted. And thank you all for coming. Thank you very much. This first poem I'll read is about falling and rising moods, with the implication that what's high usually comes down and what's low eventually gets higher. The logic of opposites. Serbia is on my back. Waco was my failure. In Birmingham, Hiroshima, Belfast, I'm implicated in the world's disgraces. Every mood is in me, every feeling. Chain reactions blow up laboratories, cities. When they take place in my head, they tip my balance. Like someone plunging from a height, I fill with terror, with what did I do wrong, with make this not be happening, with let me out of life's vicious double-crossing trick. I fall. I beg my bones, get ready not to break. I want to play touch football in your yard again. Let's see what links events and moods, and why I'm always drawn into catastrophe scenarios. I miss happiness. I want this graveyard spiral over with. The future rolling, our clothes flying off again. No more images of leg bits and exposed bones. You don't think up and down have much in common. You tell me one can only fall so far, can ascend to any height. You send fragile capsules full of delicate machinery into space. Sure, you'll catch them later. I'm imagining black holes, poisoned oceans, fallout from precision bombs. I'd rather have your van, your lab coat, your hefty bag of dead grass and dandelions. Most of all, I'd like to give you one more piece of my mind. To meet your eyes is a suicidal leap. Your ideas confuse me, mix and don't mix with my own. I can't love, can't not love you, can't not blame, can't blame you. Can't stand not to understand. I'm going down. There has to be another mood. If I'm tough on life, it's just that I'm attached to it. And though I never asked for the heights of happiness, I'll pray for a miraculous recovery. Maybe I can breathe differently, raise my head, if my eyes weren't ashamed of the light falling into them. I could go running with your dogs again. The sun has reached its nadir. Now the days will gain upon the nights. It's the logic of things in opposition. I want to fall in love with you again, lie down upon whatever has accumulated in soft heaps beneath us, goose down, fallen leaves, failures, errors, and illusions. Here are my hands, unsure of their chances, extended to you. At times, things settle into place. I reached for the sun at noon, a tenth of a watt lit gracefully upon my fingertip. Let's study frailty. Tiny flies in our wine. Girls who slip from ramps at beauty pageants. Intellectuals forced out of Shanghai's windows. Lebanon, South Africa, Sudan. Computers gently parachute to Venus. I'm on my feet, noticing the shaft of light that's holding up the room. This poem is about the body, its wants and needs. And it's called Dirty Dreams and God Smiling. Breath is warm. Do people go to bed because they have the same ideals? Absorbed into his atmosphere, I was unable to remain attached to an abstraction. I was conscious only of the odd personal sounds, of the pear taste of his lips, and of my most susceptible areas and the imperative happiness to which I wanted them subjected. Afterwards, love claimed its place again. I said I loved his inside like his outside, not thinking of his mind. I loved the twists in his intestines, the pain bits sticking to the walls of all his corridors. At every station of the body, he could tell me another way to die. If he'd had the time, God would have taken great physical pleasure in making a gesture another could understand. Smiling, blushing, arousing his own instincts and sneaking into languorous, soft porn dreams, pushing himself to a point of collapse. Didn't he make us so he could laugh, touch, ache? Yes, we're alive. Flesh can be played for music. The body hurts for pleasure as dispassionately as a man taking off a shoe. Its dreams are dirty, pure, and primitive. In the sector of the brain that makes obscenities, there are smoke concerts where pleasure-blinded women writhe and flaunt their nakedness. The female body, an interior open on all sides, and perfumed with fish scales, flower sap, and seaweed, is part seduction, part intractable pain of unknown origins, part condescension, part sacrifice. When he came strutting his masculine stuff, all my breath entered him. I stretched my middle taut. His hands, as soft as the hooves of the dawn horse, left 19 kinds of scratch marks on my skin. He shone with the irresistible sex of an angel, and a bit of him entered me. The implacability of the body. I've tried to domesticate this beast. I've bathed it, fed it, tended to its indiscretions, stroked it, clothed it, lived at its bidding, called it by my name. But is it mine? I hate my leg for going to sleep, hate my head for aching, hate being told all the time how I feel. I don't mind shoulders, ankles, even breasts, with all the names they're given by the fearful and obsessed. But I can't explain nudity or the fault I find in secret with his neck hair. I'm just his lover, tidied and meticulous. But how sweet that spot on his chest when he coughs, yawns, breathes. When he parts his lips, how sweet the teeth. Yes, we've got to know pain. And how to drink the air, its odors of dead saints fed to flames, its scents of lemon soap and of the reluctant coupling of snow leopards. Am I naked enough, I ask, plaiting my hair to make him stare again? Aren't I an interesting arrangement of bones, nerves, muscles, luxuriating in itself, hiding in its hiding place, itself, biting the heavy thread of pain embroidering its flesh, and even while sleeping, conscious of its existence? Yes. And knowing whether, just before our blood dries up and our bones turn white, we'll be trying to remember how it felt to have a passion, or still be riding that wild horse down. Read a slightly lighter poem about how we are all implicated, whether we admit it or not, in our modern-day versions of the 1848 California Gold Rush. The poem takes place in Chicago and right about now. It's called 1848/1996. The motorcycle cop was performing rodeo stunts when I called, "That all you got, bike boy? I've been counting on some serving and protecting." Yesterday, while Chicago's best put on their Denver boots, Ms. Nature kicked some lake into the planetarium. The lower stars got soaked. Today, the air is thin and gold. I'm in fake fur. He's in sergeant's blues. He gets a hot dog. I make do with coffee. He asks if I want something else. Like a contestant in a beauty pageant who can't say bologna sandwich, I reply, "World peace." Everybody comes to private terms with public eyes. Should I limp apologetically around a classy bash in fume-faded satin when all the other partygoers sparkle loud enough to make Miss Universe feel shabby? Or be glad I've got a mouth on me, lines I care to speak? While gusts begin to whip at us, I show the cop my lowest card. I once undressed for a magazine, like starlets do for art. I did it to be nude. Nobody's girl was everybody's baby after that, for $500 Everybody's glitter-driven nitwits, what I was. Though I'd studied all the best plays in the language. Now I know my destiny. No destiny. Now, of all the tragic, comic, and romantic heroes, it's the fools I love. Who cares who they are? They just walk on and harmonize. Nothing like the fools in the commodities exchange, where we go to lose the gale. Here, it blusters inside. These guys buy whatever sells. Wheat, pork bellies, gold. Gold can mean money, power, fame, adoration. Anything wanted more than anything. It's gold that's voted on in dummy corporations, counted up after final countdowns, divvied up after sudden death, raked in while questioning the best evangelists. Can rich, richer, richest lead to broke? At the policeman's ball, I wear my good junk jewelry. He wears his silver star. We dance. He sings in my ear. Heart like a wheel. Both verses. You belters out of platinum hits, this fellow's just as musical. Could get himself a spread at the top of the country and western chart. Though I'm not big on dominance. Let's just have some fun. Act like ladies, gentlemen. Make this gym a theater where no costumes hide puny shoulders, guns and knives, puny brains, cocaine and veins, puny souls, loaded dice. The blindness of the fools in everyone and the insights. And each player can take home an 8x10 of one of our best dead movie stars. Winter's last freezes are nasty. Lines are down, trains. Loop saloons can't manage the executives. I beat the mob out. Now I'm parked a few blocks south, cozy in the suede of my brand new 87 Cavalier. Try it on, Sugarfoot. Warm your hands in mine, while mine stay warm in yours. Later, we can cut a song. Never know what might go gold. This poem seems at first to be about female weakness, but it isn't. It's called Positions of Strength, and there is an epigraph which is a Chinese proverb. If you have to be a human being, don't be a woman. On a street lined with sycamores and ginkgos, as in Shanghai, in a house with no pretext to strength, built high off the street, where dust hangs in the air like talcum in a lady's dressing room, there's a Siamese cat, a vase of hothouse flowers, birds of paradise, and two women talking, as if not about themselves, about being women. They talk about Indian women in their women's quarters with their incense, silks, and English bric-a-brac. There's no monsoon here, but it does rain. The women are afraid of lingering colds. They speak of roofs, enclosures. The subject of despair comes up. They hear disillusion in the syllables of women's names. They see depth and darkness in the slightest bit of wall or window pane, or in any face, any landscape, anything. If you have to be a human being, don't be a woman. Your happiness and even your grief will depend on others in whom you'll see things that may not be there. Your self-possession will keep changing hands. Your endless battles against dirt, friction, sobs like fists in your throat, and spells of adoring sickness will be yours alone. Before any man had ever seen you, you wore your mother's lipstick and drugstore perfumes squeezed from the reproductive glands of tortoises. You made eyes and giggled or got tears in your ears because you didn't smell of calla lilies. You were stupid. When the cinnabar maple spread its branches and you moved your hands across some man, your foolishness increased. You were afraid your wrists would snap, your inner walls collapse. Yet it was his shoulder blades, fragile as a goat's, that you wept over. No one ever cried like that for you. That's why you did it. He'd pull a blanket over his nose and let nothing get to him, not even the dust. The hell with it. Like a Tibetan girl of 26 betrothed to a toddler prince, you saw his limitations and no way around them. You ended up with a pregnancy you fixed and some postcards from Brazil. Your self-disgust, you got back doubled. When you woke up, it would hit you. Rain again. You'd lie there and imagine a catastrophe for him while he sat inside your ribcage, ridiculing you. His voice became your own. You're weak. He had the nerve to think the house was waiting, not to mention the canisters and clocks, the linen and African flax. Just because you stroked his feet and kissed his knees, carried him, a phantom baby, to full term. The house tilts. Dirt piles up against the back screen door. Don't trust anyone. Most of all, don't trust a woman with two faces, any woman who in all that giving needs something. Keep away from mothers huddling in the playground, interfering and indignant. Mothers who talk nonsense to their children and their husbands. Mothers who, when the kids finally stop crying, weep. Mothers who trick kids and husbands out of terrors, then are left alone with their own fears. Tears in the carpet and curtains. Tears in the soup and tea. Never be a widow. Even if, like Indian women, you believe your husband was the incarnation of a Hindu deity, he won't leave you much. Walking pneumonia, the frost-bound garden, the house, a travel poster. Egypt, with her camels and feluccas, with her banyans, their roots and branches fused, and with lotus columns, pyramids, the Nile. Still is cold out, close to the record. The windows, iced with crystals, are no longer windows. A couple of women talk to the fire. Ask why it dies. Ask why men embrace them, erase them, use them to get born or get a leg up into heaven, leaving them behind, bodhisattvas at the gate and in the rain and cold of interiors that no man knows. There are no sexual mutilations here, no bride burnings, just two women talking, just one woman, really, with nothing left, but that she can still blush, fall in love, extend herself to anything as if it were as sentient and complex as she. Nothing left, but that when the Columbine opens wide, and the trees seem female, she can cry for them. For the delicate evergreens, and for the chestnut tree as it pulls itself to leaf again. For any man, each hour, for every brick and creature. And for the dust that will be back every other day. On this street, paved with oyster shells, in the faded yellow house, where a woman's glad to say how much she had that she could give away. Well, this last poem that I'm going to read is about happiness, and it's seen in the poem as a village. The poem is called Down the Interstate, and there is an epigraph from Song of Solomon, which goes, "His left hand is under my head, and his right hand doth embrace me." We needed guarantees we couldn't have on the happiness we would. You said we'd build a house in one of those out-of-town spots I'd summered in. Ponchatoula, Thunderbolt, Kirong. Any of those villages where men and women fish hip deep together. And the sky between high leaves glitters brighter than the leaves, and that I knew I had to get back to. Fit for love or nothing. Some days I slept all day. Some days I cleaned house all night. Some days I took myself in hand and tore myself apart. It seemed that moods, when taken far enough, could include their contraries. If struggle's end was peace, then down the interstate there might be a village with cottages and dogs, granaries and groves, invisible from the road, exotic in its innocence. We waited for the wind or anything to bring from anywhere, the sensuousness of the simple. Every morning's rush, with its idlings and revvings up, spoke our hesitations and our hopes. We waited for the summer, or whatever else might answer resignation with reprieve. And all at once, we saw that what we'd waited for, though not in easy reach, was straight ahead. A place we entered with no confidence, though it transfigured us, as if we'd seen endangered cranes dancing on artesian springs. A sanctuary made of nothing but the love that we'd begun and in which we'd stayed. We doubted we could stay for long, though natives here keep saying, time has time for everything. They teach us to steal honey from under rocks projecting over chasms. Is it wrong to hope to stay, or merely foolish? I'll find you at the window, watching fireflies, and be happy I can thank you for all kindness, all intelligence, for taking me out of my hands and making me happy, and for my love, though it's in flux from substance to illusion, memory to wish, need to happiness, and back. Love meets extremes halfway. Contradictions don't exist. Nothing here exists but for us until we live it. A pair of long-term transients, doting old villagers. We walk in an accord with time that makes time unimportant. Luxury. How little it can consist of. The air here, where earth and heaven take it easy on us. Some snowy day, when the ground is the same pale blur as the sky, we'll lay claim to both of them, to everything in this fragile fortress that gives us much protection from the future and the past, as happiness can. Thank you.